Hello and welcome to another episode of The Front Page. We've had a cluster of brilliant racing over the weekend, which we're going to look back on, and of course all the hot topics in the racing world. Joined in the studio by Jonathan Harding. 2 weeks in a row you're back on. John, so much good racing to get over. Arsenal won the derby. It's been a good weekend for you, surely?
It's been a perfect sporting weekend, really. Great racing, and then Gabriel towering above everybody at Tottenham Stadium. Yeah, great.
Yeah, good. And over in France, we're going to be joined by Scott Burton, who was there yesterday to pick up some of those art clues. Don't give too much away, Scott, but we're just chatting off air about the day. A busy day and lots of really top class racing you got to see over on Sunday.
Yeah, it was a fantastic day. It's always, I'd like to say informative, but it always throws up nearly as many questions as answers. So lots to chew over there.
Right then, let's get stuck straight into it. Loads of really good racing. John, you're going to take us through the start of it. Classic weekend, the final classic of the season. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a proper weekend of racing, wasn't it? It's difficult to know exactly where to start because we had Britain, Ireland, France, and even further afield, there was some British winners as well. So, I mean, the logical place will be the St. Ledger. We had Jan Brugel winning that for Aidan O'Brien. Countless St. Ledgers that he's won, but a really impressive winner of that. In Ireland, we then had Economics winning the Irish champion. Probably, I would suggest, Bar City of Troy, probably the most exciting horse in training in terms of potential. The question mark over the arc was very quickly ruled out. Whether that he would go there, looks like that will be one for next season. But then we did get some arc clues at Longchamp, several arc clues actually, with the favourite Luc de Vega being beaten. We had Blue Stocking enter into the equation with a really convincing success in the Prix-Vermeil. So it's I'll start wherever you'd like to, really, with a discussion. There's so much to go at.
Well, the Ledger is, as you started there, Jan Broyhill winning, beating Illinois, his stablemate. Sean Levy, big winner for him. I thought it was impressive. This horse could be sort of a Gold Cup horse. Talk perhaps he could be at the Melbourne Cup. He's an exciting horse, and you know he is one that's going to be exciting next season, just as well as the back end of this.
Yeah, and I think the Sean Levy angle was particularly nice. You know, that struck me as the real story there, actually, as a guy who started his career at Ballydoyle and gets rides for them and has won big races for them. But this is, for him, a way of repaying the faith that they've shown in him. I think he's a fantastic jockey, Sean Levy. I thought he spoke incredibly well afterwards. And as for the horse, yeah, and even the second, Illinois and Jan Brugel, there's two serious staying horses there. So two to look forward to.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, what did you make of the Ledger?
It was an exciting race, obviously. You always wonder when they cross the line, and the commentator was saying, they got a bit close there, and then the bing bong goes, you think, well, nothing's going to happen because they're two stablemates or whatever. And then obviously it transpired, it was the third and the fourth that had come together. He's a big raw unit, isn't he, Jan Brugel? And I thought Sean Levy gave him a terrific ride because he did not want to drop the bit at all the way down the back. He looked like he was reefing and wrestling to get out and get on with it. And obviously, if you're going to be a classy stayer, you need to run the race the right way around. I think if he learns to settle without the assistance of the jockey, I think he could be even better, and he would therefore give himself a chance of going even further in a Melbourne Cup or an Ascot Gold Cup. Would be the logical way to go. Three-year-olds, Northern Hemisphere three-year-olds, have actually got quite a good record in recent years in the Melbourne Cup, so that would be an interesting thing. And of course, other members of the O'Brien family have won it, but Aidan hasn't won it yet. So that would be something for him. As I say, Levy gave him an absolutely brilliant steer. Nothing against Wayne Lorden on Illinois. I suppose with my Arc and French hat on, it would have been nice to have seen Illinois win because he was quite close behind Sozi in the Grand Prix de Paris, but he doesn't know how to run a bad race, does he? He was very close to Los Angeles in the Great Voltigeur after that, very close to winning a Ledger here. He's a very, very good horse, Illinois, and he's a good marker horse, so plenty to take out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll go on to Ireland. Economics. He is that exciting horse again, isn't he? We hoped at the start of the season he might progress into something after that brilliant Dante win. We didn't see him in the derby. They decided to sort of be patient with him. It was a bit of a decision people had their own opinions on, but it seems to be justified. I love that performance from him. Got his head down a little bit. I love his head carriage, the way he boxed and won it. He's a very exciting horse going forward. And William Haggis, after the race, compared him to Baid and said, "We've got another." Do we agree?
Yeah, I mean, it was terrific, wasn't it? Saying, you know, you can't believe one comes along in Baid and then you get another one so quickly. You don't expect that as a trainer at any level. Yeah, I think he absolutely fits that brief. And you talk about the discussion around targets, and it's quite often, well, the trainer knows best and the trainer does know best, but we're allowed to get excited. We're allowed to think about what might this horse achieve. We're allowed to take a view on where they might go. That's what is so appealing about racing, is that we have this level of debate, and all he's done there is make us and indeed his connections set their sights even higher, really. I mean, the fact that I would have loved to see him in an arc, but I can see the argument for maybe waiting a year. And as William Haggis said, if he is that good, then he can carry a penalty and still be competitive in an arc. So look, he's hugely exciting. He's being campaigned in a typically sort of William Haggis way. They're just doing what's right by the horse each time, feeling their way through. No rush to step him up in trips. Similar calls for Baid. It's almost blow for blow, really. And that was a big step up in a serious race. And you talk about marker horses like Illinois. I mean, to do that to August Rodin, who was on a going day, he is capable of throwing.
He's a very good horse on his day.
But when he is on song, he is exceptional. And he was yesterday, and he was good enough to win that race were it not for economics.
Yeah, I think the remarkable thing is this horse only broke his maiden in April.
Yes, you know? Quick.
And I remember being at Newbury that day, and William Haggis was, I want to say, just downbeat, but he wasn't by any means getting exciting. You would have not walked away from that race thinking, we've seen a champion here. Just thought this would be an ordinary sort of maiden winner, and we'll see where we go with him. And he's just progressed and progressed. It's quite a remarkable story.
And that race is the type that I think we'll look back on. I always think about the Shima Classic won by Equinox, and you look back and the form just keeps improving and improving. And I think it'll be a similar race. How many group ones are they going to go on and win that group? And I think Shin Emperor as well in third ran a fantastic arc prep. And he's a serious horse in his own right. So, yeah, really, just great race, basically, and a joy to watch.
Yeah, well, that leads me perfectly on to going to Scott now, because we potentially saw Shin Emperor, as you said, now 8-1, and Los Angeles in fourth, potentially archetypes. Scott, what did you make of those two runs, and of course, the winner?
I think I'd like to say something about economics first, because, of course, he came to Deauville instead of going to York. They could have gone to the International, and this is a terrific piece of target training, if you like, because obviously Sheikh Issa is a key member of the Bahraini Royal Family, and Bahrain Turf Club, Royal Bahrain, sponsor the RS champion. So if you're going to dangle a carrot in front of the owner and say, we don't want to go for the Derby, you better offer a big carrot, as it were. And winning their race was a really, really big target for them. And they decided the way to do it was to go via the Group 2 in Deauville. What I think most people watching on television won't be able to get their head around is just how big this horse is. I mean, he'd jump a fence, to use a hoary old cliche. He's a big, big horse, and they've had to give him time, and they've given him the time he needs. I thought Tom Marquand gave him a really, really top-class ride, because obviously we've seen countless jockeys go over to Ireland with big chances on horses that have essentially been running against a team of Valley Doyle horses. And even if you might have thought that maybe August Rodin and even Los Angeles might have been ridden a bit closer to Luxembourg, and he had the chance to get out and get close to them, I thought it was a terrific ride from him. And the horse showed immense guts, because August Rodin, I'm sure, I haven't looked at the sectionals, but must have posted a faster 2 furlongs to the furlong marker. He really came at him and basically must have gone a head up on him. And to battle back afterwards, I think he's just a top, top class animal. And William Haggis and Maureen and the entire team at Somerville Lodge have earned the right to name their targets from here on in. I think it's great fun to try and plot courses for these top class horses, but they're not in need of any backseat drivers. They seem to know what they're doing. Going on to Shin Emperor and Los Angeles as well, they both ran fantastic arc trials, I think. Shin Emperor, when you watch his third place in the Japanese Derby back. He took quite a long time to get organised. He was on very, very fast ground, which typically is what you get in Japan. He's obviously, he's French bred. He's a full brother to Sotsas. And Yoshito Yahagi bought him at the sales in Deauville and told the breeder, Henri Bozo, I'm going to bring this horse back and run him in the art. And he's been good to his word. And he just seemed that bit more comfortable on what was still quite quick ground at Leopardstown, but would be nothing like as fast as he gets in Tokyo and places like that. So he just seemed that to travel that much more kindly for his jockey. And there was a moment when Auguste Rodin swept down the outside and came to kind of eyeball economics, and they both probably shifted a lane to their left. And suddenly the gap disappeared for him. And he, all of a sudden, he looked like he was going to be sixth. And in the blink of an eye, he was third and closing. And I think that was a very, very exciting performance with a view to the arc. Yoshito Yahagi said afterwards that he hadn't got the work into him he'd hoped to get into him before he left for France because of the hot weather in Japan, and that he reckoned he was only 70 or 80% fit. And if he can get that extra improvement for having run at Leopardstown and he's somewhere near concert pitch on Arc Day, he's going to be right in there at pitching at the death.
Okay, insight there from Scott, given the horse has been trained in France for his European campaign, and some interesting insight about economics, perhaps a triumph hurdle bid on the cards. It's going to be the Champion Stakes next for him. Worth mentioning as well, Kyprios continued his dominance in the stairs, really good performance. Brad Sell, fantastic in the Flying Five, and lots of other clues. Lake Victoria now favourite for the Oaks and the 1,000 guineas after winning so impressively. Porta Fortuna, Breeders' Cup, the next target for her after a good win. Loads of top class racing in France. We've done Britain, we've done Britain and Ireland. Let's head to France. Scott, what did we learn yesterday?
I wrote in my main report yesterday that everybody turned up thinking this was going to be the day to learn about the three-year-olds. The Prenial looked a fantastic race on paper between Look to Vega and Sozi, and Ambient Friendly obviously was second in our derby as well, excuse me. And then there was a raft of three-year-olds in the Prix Vermeil, and in a 12-runner field, a really, really high-quality 12-runner field, only three older fillies and mares, but one of those, Blue Stocking, absolutely punched her ticket to the arc, should that be the way they decide to go. Rafe Beckett had a fantastic weekend. Obviously, we've touched on Dogster. Kin Ross looked right back to his very best there. He was having winners left, right and centre, and Ross Orion rode Blue Stocking like she was the best horse in the race, slotted in behind the Wertheimer Pacemaker half day. And although the filly that half day was making the pace for, Aventure, came out of the pack and looked actually to almost get level at one stage, Blue Stocking was much too tough in the end. And what I like about the way she's been campaigned this year, she was a permanent bridesmaid last year. She had a row of twos next to her name. And they started her off in the Middleton, and she won then. That was the day after the ARC entries. And as Ray Beckett pointed out yesterday, she hadn't even won a listed race at that point. She'd been second in a classic, but she'd not actually won a stakes race. So they didn't feel there was, you know, they had any business entering in the ARC. Now, it's going to cost them €120,000 to do it. And there are obviously discussions to be had with Barry Mann, Chudmont Farms, and the family of the late Miss Carlin. But there seems to be a will to go there and do it. And she's got exactly what you need. She enjoyed the track. She stays the trip very, very well. It actually dried out quite a lot yesterday, although the official ground was souple in French terms, which would probably be good to soft. In UK and Irish terms, it was a warm and sunny day yesterday, and it was probably quick enough. And so she won't be one of those that minds if it does rain between now and October the 6th. And I think she's very, very much worth her chance. Aventure lost nothing in defeat in second. They'll decide whether they want to go to the Arc, go to the Opera, or even the Prix de Royleur, which is the Group One on the Saturday, which is for fillies only and is a mile and six. Further back, opera singer Christophe Soumillon said she didn't really handle the ground. She was fifth, never really got closer. And Sparkling Plenty, who they were running in the Vermeil, the Deanne winner, who was third, and are staying on third to opera singer in the Nassau. She was parked out the back, never really got involved, came home sixth. Not really sure what conclusions you can draw from that, but she's surely an opera filly, you would think. And then on to the Niel, which after such a kind of a humdinger of a May, had a lot to live up to. And almost the worst thing that could happen did happen, which was that a very good German colt called Augustus was declared a non-runner. And therefore, his pacemaker, Wintertraum, didn't bother to pacemate. And there were just basically four other jockeys looking at each other. And Luc de Vega had to make his own pace. He came under pressure halfway up the straight. Sozi drew past him. Delius went past him in the end. He finished third in a tired-looking third. And we wanted to know, would he stay a mile and a half? It had been so brilliant over an extended mile and a quarter in the jockey club. And I'm not sure we had the answer, to be honest. The thought in the camp was that he just got tired. He basically blew up, but he wasn't anywhere near fit for this, because the idea is that the Niel brings you on for the arc. It's like an extra piece of work, if you like. It obviously hadn't been ideal that he had to make his own running, but Jan Lerner, who trains Luc de Vega in conjunction with his father, Carlos, basically was at pains to say that he'd asked Roland Thomas to make sure that if nobody else took it on, that he took it on, because he didn't want it turned into a complete tactical farce, because they wouldn't find anything out, but more to the point, he wouldn't have the proper work he needs in terms of his progression towards the arc. So they're not giving up on him. Stosie was very good and very professional. He's trained by Andre Farb, who is never going to have his Briniel runner at 100%, so there's more to come from him as well. Delius is a horse who keeps improving for Jean-Claude Rouget and Coolmore, and was closing Sozi down at the end, so he's in the mix as well. All three of them, I assume, will turn up in 3 weeks' time. Would it be a surprise if one of them won? Absolutely not. Sozi's now 4-1, 5-1 favourite. The bookmakers didn't push Luc de Vega out too far. I think they've seen this movie plenty of times before in terms of horses that get turned over in messily run tactical trials. Ultimately speaking, my impression from the weekend is that the best three-year-old that's going to run in the race is Shin Emperor.
Okay, so would that be your fancy looking ahead for the arc now?
I thought Blue Stocking impressed me as well. It wouldn't surprise me at all if it is actually a year that goes to one of the older horses. So from that point of view, I think our riff has a chance. I think Blue Stocking's a big chance. And at a crazy price, don't write off Marquez de Savigny as well, just because she's never run over a mile and a half. Andre Farb will train her completely differently, having not had to run since the Jean Romanet in the middle of August. And her owner breeder, Edward de Rothschild, said it's all stamina in the family. He's absolutely no doubt she'll stay. So I think Blue Stocking and Al Riffer and Marquise de Savigny all bring very, very solid form from the older horses. If it's going to be a three-year-old, it'll be Shin Emperor.
Okay, good. Bit of a solid... Four. Go on.
They're just the four to pick from.
Indeed. Big solid nod when he said Al Riffer, I spotted there.
Yeah, I'm trying to stick with one horse.
You're not going to go for four?
Well, after a weekend like this, it does flick around a little bit. And Light Scott, love Shin Empress, Chance, Blue Stocking, I just love Full Stop. I think if she lines up, she's going to be bang there. But I've been Al Riffer since the Eclipse. I just think he was screaming out for a mile and a half. Showed that was absolutely the case when winning what has traditionally been an excellent trial for the Arc in Germany. Just a lot lines up for him, so I'm going to stick with Al Riffer, although he's shortened a great deal since Sander.
Yeah, interesting. And I suppose we had in the studio last week the discussion about geldings in the Arc. After Blue Stocking did that, the Goliath team will be scratching their heads a little bit more, thinking, oh, yeah, if only we could go. We're not going to get back into that debate. It was well done last week. Final word about another star name who was at Doncaster, I suppose, was Sir Keir Starmer. A surprise appearance, given he was meeting Joe Biden in America on Friday. Went up with Lady Starmer. He's the first PM to appear on the day, on St. Ledger Day, since Winston Churchill in 1953. He said there aren't many better days out than a day at the races in the sunshine. So it's a pleasure to be back at Doncaster for the St. Ledger. That's a big positive. Lee's written in his column, acting Prime Minister showing an interest in the sport. It's clearly expressing his... I mean, look, it's not going to solve all of racing's problems having the Prime Minister there, but an ear in his ear. A couple of trainers spoke to him. I think David Menutia said he didn't have enough time to discuss Brexit with Zahir Starmer, but I'm sure he'd have opinions there, being based in Britain, but of course from France. You know, obviously, popularity of prime ministers is always going to be a different issue. There were some interesting comments made towards him from social media pictures, but he did win an election in a landslide. Good to see the backing of a PM at Donny, surely.
It is. I mean, he had a great weekend, really, meeting Biden on Friday, St. Ledger on Saturday, and then watching Arsenal win on Sunday. I mean, it was nearly as good as mine. It's fantastic, really. There was a lot of fear that when the Conservatives lost the election, that Labour would somehow be a completely different approach and you'd have to basically start from zero and win them over in the first sort of few months. But there is a lot of love for racing within the Labour Party. Just because the connections aren't quite as established as they were with the Conservatives, that doesn't mean they won't be. So it's broadly very positive, yes.
Having
the Prime Minister showing an interest.
Absolutely, and I think irrelevant of political stance or where they stand, he's government, he's the man in charge, isn't he? You want him back in the sport. So, no, good to see. Okay, well, loads of racing there to look back on the weekend. And if you're a Racing Post member, you can look back on our race replays. Okay, on to the big story from last week is the retirement of legendary trainer Sir Michael Stout. His first winner in April 1972. He's been one of Britain's biggest, most successful flat trainers. Scott, tell us more about the great man who's going to finish his racing career at the end of the season.
Well, I think for people of a certain vintage, and unfortunately I qualify for that, he's been such a huge figure in racing for... It's 52 years, do we say now? But across 6 decades, essentially, he's just been a model of consistency more than anything else. Somebody who turned out Group 1 caliber horses year after year after year. He had a huge rivalry with Sir Henry Cecil, the other racing knight in Newmarket. But it kind of waxed and waned in some ways because Cecil went through parts of his career where he suffered with owners leaving. They both, obviously, at the same time, obviously, suffered with the foundation of Godolphin because both had been supported by Sheikh Mohammed quite heavily. Cecil went through the doldrums more than once in his career. And Stout just had this almost metronomic ability to turn up a good horse nearly every year. I think the figures were something like, it was 40 years... 36 out of the last 40 years up to 2022 when he last won the Derby. He'd had a Group 1 winner, at least one Group 1 winner. If you grew up, when I did, as I say, I was just 10 when Shergar won the Derby, which was just one of the most exciting things you'll ever see as a racing man, youngster. That is, if anything's going to light the fuse, that would be it, because he just went further and further clear. And he'd done the decent thing by running in the first of his trials on a weekend. So, you know, you could sit and watch it on a Saturday afternoon on ITV, as it was then, at Sandown. It was then the Guardian Classic trial. He was a fantastically exciting horse, and just the way he used to just destroy his opposition, did it again in the Irish Derby under Lester Biggott. Because Walter Swinburne was suspended, and then the King Georgie was sumptuous as well, just one doing handstands. And I think possibly there was an element of me that, even though I didn't really quite understand what the pre-triumph was at the time, I was a little bit angry at them for running the St. Ledger on the wrong ground and when he finished fourth instead of waiting for the arc. But he not only lit my enthusiasm for flat racing and top-class flat racing, but really sealed an awful lot of members of the racing public's affection for Sir Michael and for Walter Swinburne as well. And much like I think Lee Motter said, our colleague wrote during the course of the week, they were my team growing up. And so I remember being at Ascot for the Queen Elizabeth II Stakes when Zelzal won 1989, and down by the rail, and terrific duel with Polish president, a very, very good miler of Andre Favre and Sheikh Mohammed. And Swinburne looked like he was, from my low down vantage point, bear in mind there's quite a stiff riser at Asker, they kind of came around the bottom of the bend, and Zilzow looked like he was in real trouble. And then just in the blink of an eye, he was three lengths clear. I'm sure if you watch the video back, it's probably not as dramatic, but from my, as I say, never been that tall, my vantage point at the age of 18, 19, he just sauntered clear. And the names that have been recalled this week, the Singspiels and the Pilsudskis, and even right up to Bay Bridge, obviously, was another good older horse. We always used to talk about the typical stout improver, the horses that maybe even started off in handicaps as three-year-olds, maybe ran once at two or what have you, but then developed on at four and five to be top-class pattern horses. And the other thing about his career was that back in especially the 1990s, when the big international targets first started opening up, so Breeders' Cups, Japan Cups, Hong Kong, places like that, he was a really early adopter of that. Maybe some of those targets are now harder to win than they were then, but he was sending his very best horses. People often ask, well, you know, what would it take for a European horse to win the Japan Cup? Well, you have to send a horse of Singspiel or Pilsudski's caliber to win it. These were proper horses campaigned in an exciting swashbuckling style. Once that they were patiently handled until they got to their peak, and then they were campaigned aggressively once they'd reached their sort of full maturity, as it were. I'll tell you one more story about growing up watching him. He had. Again, you have to bear in mind that flat racing used to, there was no all-weather racing. Where flat racing used to basically go into hibernation after the November handicap at Doncaster. And so you would come back for the Craven meeting, which was televised on ITV and then Channel 4. And then the 1,000 guineas was on a Thursday in those days. And throughout the 80s, Stout kept hitting the woodwork. It looked like he would never win the 1,000 guineas because it was the first important race of the year. And I was making a list of it. He had five horses during the 1980s, at least five that I've met, really proper top-class horses. They all went on to win Group 1s. Milligram, Bella Calora, Royal Heroine, Sonic Lady, Double Weyer, really, really top-class horses that all hit the woodwork in the 1,000 guineas. It looked like he would never do it, and he finally won in 1989 with Musical Bliss. And it was kind of like a weight off of his shoulders. I'm sure it was a weight off of Walter Swinburne's shoulders. And from there, the floodgates opened, six derbies. I mean, just a masterful trainer of classic and top-class middle-distance milers. He made his name back in the 1970s training sprint handicappers. And let's not forget, he won a Triumph Hurdle and a champion hurdle with Cribensis, so essentially you could train anything. And he is one of the giants of the 20th century British racing scene and the international scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Scott makes a massive point there that perhaps hasn't been reported as well as some of the others. His international success is quite extraordinary and really trendsetter. When we're back there talking about all these races that they could go, he was really one of the pioneers of going and exploiting those opportunities. I find there aren't many trainers that have the same sort of aura as a Michael Stout runner, even in lesser meetings and stuff. He's got that sort of background to him, but also that element of a typical Stout improver. There aren't many trainers that have sort of a trademark and sort of a style as much as he does. Yeah. What's your favourites and what's your reaction to the news this week?
I think much like everybody else, just huge deference and respect for him and how he's driven racing forward and been an ambassador for the sport. He wasn't always the most sort of engaged with the press, let's say, but that was part of it. That was part of his sort of style. It was, Sir Henry Cecil was a bit more engaged, a bit more willing to play a role, whereas Sir Michael Stout was a bit more reserved, a bit more calculated. But you need
horses did the talking.
That exactly, and you need those different personalities. And he's, it's always fascinating when somebody goes down there and sits down with him for a big interview because you know it's going to be entertaining. And part of the game is getting something out of him. And I love all that. I love the whole the whole aura surrounding him. He is one of the greats, and the greatest compliment you can pay really is the fact that, you know, I didn't grow up during the Stout heyday, as it were, yet I'm still completely aware of all those big horses, what they achieved, what Sir Michael Stout achieved. That is legacy, and his is one that will go down as possibly one of the greatest ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Man of few words, as you say. He said it's a great and enjoyable journey, is how he described it. Other things to note there, 10-time champion trainer in Britain and once in Ireland, over 4,000 winners in Britain. So a real star name. And we've got another retirement this week. Franny Norton, John, you've spoken to.
Yes.
Going to bow out at Chester on Saturday.
Where else?
Of course.
Yeah, great. Went down to Lingfield to have a chat with him ahead of time, and he's just reached the point now where I think he probably would have kept going. Hopefully not speaking out of turn there, I think he would. But
he's 54.
The opportunities have started to dry up a little bit and the game's slightly retired him, but he's had a fantastic career. You know, he's one of those that he's had ebbs and flows. He's not been at the top all the time, like his good friend Frankie Dettori. You know, he's had to duck and dive a little bit, but he's, that association with Mark Johnson is one of the keys to his longevity. He's ridden some fantastic horses with him. He's ridden a lot of horses, a lot of winners, and yeah, just another great character, to be honest with you. He could have quite easily been a professional boxer, but decided to be a professional jockey instead, which is a wonderful decision to have to make, and it actually was a decision he had to make. So it's racing's gain that he stuck at it in the saddle.
Absolutely, almost 2,000 winners, a hugely successful career. And Chester, of course, it's going to be quite the day, you'd imagine, on Saturday. He rides around there better than anyone else. So I'm going to have to struggle come that May meeting. I just back Franny Norton. I'm going to have to do some real homework now and look at draws and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I try to understand why, and I asked him that question, like, what is it about Chester? And it's just something about it that just clicks for him. He rides it so well regardless of where he's drawn, because it is so important where you're drawn. But he's just, it almost is that little bit of duck and diving. He's very tactically aware when he's riding around there, and indeed everywhere. But he's it means a lot to him, Chester. You know, he's saying that unlike other courses, you get atmosphere around the entire track rather than just when you're coming up the straight. I think he thrives off that, and the only issue I have with him is that he's a Liverpool fan, but other than that, he's, you know, fantastic jockey, and wishing him all the best in retirement, whatever comes next. I think he wants to help the next generation of people come into racing. He wants to work with young people from perhaps areas that wouldn't necessarily, you know, just be associated with
horse
racing.
Yeah, he has a non-racing background himself, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he's a good role model in that sense, and yeah, wishing him all the best.
Yeah, look forward to that. Scott, Franny, veteran of that weighing room, but hugely successful career.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reading Jordan's piece. I'd forgotten. He just to link back to Sir Michael, he rode Deposky to win the Ebor for Stout in 1991. And he did 7'3" to do it. Now, it's clearly in the 21st century a great thing that British Racing has raised the minimum weights quite substantially since then. But he's really, I think, almost the best thing you can say about Franny Norton is that he's kind of survived the death of the lightweight jockey, if you like. Again, that wishing to be the old grump on the program. When I was growing up, there were a raft of 10 or 15 jockeys who basically made a living out of being able to do the bottom half of competitive handicaps. And, you know, jockeys like John Lowe and Gary Bardwell, who was a dual apprentice, who managed it for a while, and then say that the minimum weights rose, and they've risen again since then. And Franny managed to survive the raising of those weights. He could do very, very light weights. Terrifically strong jockey, but also one who never really apparently struggled with his weight. And the guy he reminds me of, that I probably know better, is Thierry Jarnet, who, you know, rider of Trèves, won 4 Arcs, rode for André Favre for a long time, very, very successful jockey here in France, probably had many more opportunities than Franny Norton did, but was absolutely committed to just a very healthy lifestyle, not in a kind of weird West Coast California guru kind of way, but just like eating well, you know, getting sensible amounts of sleep and just basically treating yourself like a professional athlete. And maybe that came from the boxing background as well. If you're going to be good enough to be a lightweight or a flyweight boxer, you basically, every pound has got to be strength and power, hasn't it? So he's been able to survive in an era where just being able to do a lightweight would have previously given you a career, didn't give you a career anymore, and he managed to manage that transformation to an era when you know, probably a bit more than he wanted to, but stayed supremely fit. And I think, you know, he's a year younger than me, and frankly, I wouldn't want to run for a bus against him, really. I wouldn't see which way he went. So, no, he's been a terrific jockey for 36 some years. And you can only wish him the very, very best for his retirement.
Completely agree. Okay, we're going to have a jump story just after this quick break. Okay, our final story, and it wouldn't be me without getting a bit of jumps in there. It is September now, after all, and an interesting story from Worcester on Wednesday. This was involving conditional jockey Elizabeth Gale, who's hit with a 28-day ban for her losing ride on Catuaba. She hit the front, thinking she had the race won, with half a furlong to go, except the half furlong pole was mistaken for the winning post. She was then narrowly beaten by 25-1 shot, the Bold Fady. Charlie Longston, the horse's trainer, said he was gutted for Elizabeth Gale. But the story gets a little bit more interesting because she's the fourth jockey at Worcester in 16 months to have mistaken the half furlong pole with the winning pole. We also had Joe Anderson get 10 days in May 2023, Bo Morgan and Tom Buckley were warned by the stewards as well after making the same mistake. But Worcester have come out this week and said that the markers look distinctly different. They said they're not going to change it. It's fine as it is. There's been various comments about what could be done. Charlie Longston said the size of a pole could be different to try and help jockeys in those final few strides. He said he went to Epsom this week and they appeared to be different. So the question remains, what should Worcester do? Is this a one-off mistake? Or is this something that action should be taken? John, Worcester seemed pretty sure that this is not their fault. An unfortunate incident, but one of those where we're scratching ahead at British Racing again.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? There's an expression I'd love to use but can't because I don't think we have a bleeping function, but it goes along the lines of things happen, you know, accidents do happen, people make mistakes, it's sport, it's happening very quickly. So the first half of this is a rider's made an error, which is hugely unfortunate, probably feels very silly about it, but it's
under conditional.
Exactly right. So they're learning, it's done, you know, serve the penalty and then crack on again. It is then the question of whether something could be reasonably done to make it as easy as possible for those jockeys. Now, it sounds to me like there is a logical solution there in making those poles even more distinct, but where do you kind of stop? It does seem to be developing as a bit of a theme there in particular. So I'm sure they will look at it at some point properly. Beyond practical solutions, I'm not entirely sure. It's not really for me to say, but I think, you know, anything that can be done to make it easier for jockeys to distinguish has to be a good thing, because it doesn't help anyone. A jockey's made an error, now can't ride for 28 days. The people who back the horse are a little bit sore. The track looks a little bit silly. No one really comes out of it well. So I think be proactive rather than reactive.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an unfortunate pattern. And you know, 28-day ban, they are the rules. I mean, it's stopped riding. It's the same as we discussed in recent weeks regarding the jockeys on the flat. But I look at this and I'd be extremely frustrated because there is a pattern and it doesn't seem... I don't know what could be done. I mean, there's various suggestions. The actual pole of a winning post, make that a different colour or something, that would be straightforward. I mean, there's lots of things they could look at. There'll be reasons for and against an unfortunate situation. Scott, how have you addressed this situation? Are we overreacting, thinking something needs to be done? Is this just a case of what happens in the game?
No, I'd have a very simple question to put to the managers at Worcester, which I should say is a fantastic track and deserves a bit of a break, really. Obviously, they've had terrible luck with the weather over multiple seasons in terms of losing fixtures to flooding and what have you. But it's what I would heartily urge anybody who gets the chance to go along there for a bit of spring or early autumn races. So fantastic summer jumping there. Really, really friendly, welcoming place. It's a jumps only track. They don't hold flat racing there. So the shortest race they're ever going to stage is 2 miles, which is 16 furlongs or 32 half furlongs. Why on earth do they need to mark the last half furlong? Most jump jockeys, I assume, measure it their way around a track in terms of how many hurdles or fences they have left to jump. I'm somewhat surprised that even at the major tracks like Cheltenham or Newbury or Haydock or anywhere else, they actually bother to have furlong markers. Now, at the dual-purpose tracks, it sort of makes sense because obviously they use it flat racing as well. But the actual distance left to travel to the line, if you've got a vague nodding acquaintance with a course as a jump jockey, if you've been out and walked it or jogged it before racing or you've just ridden there lots and lots of times before, you'll know this is the last hurdle, this is the last flight, and then how far it is to the winning post. I don't see what purpose a half furlong marker serves in a jumps race. I just, you know, there's not a 1.5 or a 2.5 furlong marker any more than there is on a flat track. It just seems like a no-brainer. You just take it out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you mentioned on Worcester, it's probably worth saying as well, the way the stands are sort of situated as well doesn't make it easy. You can see why that mistake would be made, because whereas some tracks, you know, the sort of the poles there and the stands there, it's a little bit different at Worcester, I guess, as well. So would you be in favour of sort of looking at this? And I mean, you're obviously saying take it out, but in terms of a pole itself, I mean, is that the simple answer? Is there a way of making it more clear?
Well, I'd be interested to know what the BHA must have the tracks inspectorate within the BHA must have a policy on these things, and there's presumably a requirement for there to be a half furlong pole on a jumps track and on flat tracks as well, that we have races that are divided into eighths of a mile, for want of a better phrase, but that the final eighth needs to be divided into 2/16. American racing uses 16ths all the time. They have races that are over a mile and a 16th or a mile and 3/16ths and what have you. We don't do that. We don't. You get very, very few, apart from odd track configurations, you might get something that's something and a half furlongs, you know, or 7 furlongs and 110 yards or whatever. It can happen. In France, we have the Prix Maurice de Guise, which is 6.5 furlongs. It's 1,300 metres. It's quite easy here. They have poles with, because obviously we measure everything in meters, have poles with little, they're like orange tennis balls on them, and you get 4 tennis balls for 400 meters, 3 for 300, 2 for 200, 1 for 100, and then the winning post looks suitably different. So if it's a requirement from the BHA and Worcester can't do anything about it, then at least make it look different. But I'd be interested to know if there's a really logical reason why a half furlong has to be marked out. You know, if there's, in all of the things that are going on in a jockey's mind in terms of driving the horse forward, is the horse getting tired? How many times have I raised the whip? Have I used the whip in the correct manner and not raised it above shoulder height? Am I keeping the horse in a straight line? Is the other one going to come past me and all the rest of it? There's a lot going on. And I just think having a completely meaningless marker that can, on very, very rare occasions, be mistaken for the winning post, it's just adding one extra thing that it just doesn't add anything. There's nobody sitting in the grandstand or watching at home on television is gonna wonder, oh, they've hit the half furlong, but it's only 110 yards to go. By the time your brain's registered that, they've passed the winning line. I should also say I've interviewed Elizabeth Gale a couple of times on the phone. She's a very, very clear-headed, upwardly mobile rider. She built up a really good relationship over the last couple of winters with Celeb Dalen for her bosses, I should say, Philip Hobbs and Johnson White. And she's got a very solid grounding there. She'll obviously go away and do her 28 days. She'll have good support from them when she comes back. So hopefully this won't kind of hold back her career too much. And I'm fairly sure that it's a mistake. She'll be very, very keen not to repeat. Most jockeys only have to serve one of these kinds of suspensions and then it stays with them for life. But that said, it could have been avoided potentially if the pole hadn't been there. And if it happens to a jockey that maybe is from a smaller yard or maybe is, you know, has just ridden out their claim or something like that and he's just really trying to get going and then suddenly loses 28 days like that, which I think is the right penalty if you drop your hands, by the way. And it's, you can see a reason why that's happened, then I just, you know, to me, it needs to be explained better why it's necessary to have it there in the first place.
No, completely agree. And a couple of things there. I mean, the timing of this 28-day ban is never perfect, but it's come before the core element of the season. There's some similar issues at Sandown, isn't there, with the pole there? So it's not just Worcester's issue. This sort of thing has happened elsewhere. And agreed about the length of a ban. I think those are the rules, clear cut, and it will be what will be. We'll give Elizabeth best of luck when she is back from that ban. Of course, she's back in the summer, as the winter months, all those big meetings to come. I won't get myself too excited for the jump season, as now I've got to decide what makes the front page. And I'm not going to put myself first because I know heavily criticised if I do that.
Oh, yeah, by me, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't want anything to do with that. It's got to be you, Scott. Sir Michael Stout, an absolute legend of the game. And fully deserves his place on the front page, I think. Amazing career, and as you said, just so many brilliant horses over the years. It's fully warranted, surely. Right decision.
Oh, I'd like to think so. It's a shame there wasn't a more powerful advocate for him, but I think we'll say that the sort of horses he's trained down the years do the speaking for him. So he's been a credit to the game, and we wish him a long and long happy retirement. When he finally stops, we hope there might be a couple more golden memories just yet in terms of some very nice two-year-olds he's got that may run again before the end of the season.
Yeah, plenty more to look forward to in the last stages of a flat season. Hopefully, Sir Michael can finish with a bit of a bang. Right decision, putting him on the front. John, you agree with that one? Happy
absolutely.
With that?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely.
Good, perfect. Well, made everyone happy. That's good. Thank you very much for joining us. Jonathan Harding in the studio, Scott Burton over in France, and myself, James Stevens. Join us again next week for another episode of The Front Page.